Welcome to the New Books and Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the channel with Carrie Figter. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Professor Elise Springer. Her new book is titled Communicating Moral Concern, An Ethics of Critical Responsiveness. It is published with MIT Press. Springer is an associate professor of philosophy at Wesleyan University. The long tradition of moral philosophy employs a familiar collection of basic concepts. These concepts include agent, act, intention, consequence, responsibility, obligation, the right, and the good. Typically, contemporary moral theorists simply inherit these conceptual materials, and they use them to stake their positions within the terrain the concepts establish. But we must recognize the possibility that the categories and distinctions that form moral philosophy's bedrock can nonetheless obscure or distract attention away from salient moral phenomena. Sometimes one needs to fashion new conceptual tools and refashion the old ones in order to get a handle on things. In Communicating Moral Concern, Elise Springer identifies a sphere of moral phenomena that she claims are as yet under-theorized. These phenomena have to do with the activities associated with certain forms of moral criticism that target not simply what another has brought about, nor simply the intentions and attitudes another has expressed by means of action, but also a concern with how another has employed her agency. Springer argues that in order to properly theorize the activities associated with calling attention to the agency of others, moral philosophers need to adopt a collection of new concepts. Communicating Moral Concern is a systematic and exciting reorientation of moral theory. So let's turn to the interview. Hello, Elise Springer.
Hello, Bob.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine. It's a gorgeous day in Connecticut.
Oh, that's nice. It's a pretty nice day here in Nashville, too. Thanks for joining me today on New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, listener, for tuning in to the podcast. Our topic today is Elise's new book, which is titled Communicating Moral Concern, An Ethics of Critical Engagement. This is, I should say, from the start, a highly original and very ambitious book, which makes it very refreshing. In it, Elise proposes what seems to me a fairly radical reorientation of sort of fundamental concepts and ideas in moral philosophy. And the nub of the book is the idea that we need to place at the center of our moral theorizing the concept of moral concern and a corresponding conception of moral gesture and moral critique. And there's a lot to talk about in the book, and the book takes on a lot of contemporary work in moral philosophy and connects up in interesting ways with Peter Strawson's views, with virtue ethics, with some work in sociology and moral psychology. So we've got a lot to talk about, but first, Elise, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I've always been a New Englander, and I was lucky enough to find myself working relatively close to home at Wesleyan University, where I've been for the last 10 years. I was a music major as an undergraduate, so I came pretty late to philosophy, and I really owe my interest in philosophy to a cluster of women faculty, still too rare a thing in philosophy departments, I'm afraid, but who invited me into philosophical discussions when I was an undergraduate music major, writing a thesis in music and how music carries meaning. And because of the way that they engaged me in dialogue and drew me out, but also listening to them talk with each other, right? Sometimes our greatest inspirations come from watching people who are on the road ahead of us debate encounter each other's ideas. But because of that interaction, I came to recognize that many of my own questions and concerns really were philosophical in nature, and I hadn't realized that through my whole undergraduate career.
Yeah, continue, please.
Well, I was interested in ethics from the beginning. that I'm sure will never not be part of my philosophical set of interests. But I ended up going to grad school without any philosophy under my belt, so it was quite an unusual experience. And there were three further influences that were really important to me in graduate school. I didn't have a single mentor to whom I really owe my direction, but there were a few things that were very important. One was feminist theory. I'd actually been very interested in what was then called women's studies when I was an undergraduate, and I'd always been something of a resistor and nonconformist around norms of sex and gender. So I was interested in feminist theory, and Diana Myers really drew that interest out in graduate school. And the second interest was pragmatism. That was the one course in graduate school that was like a seed that kept growing. Actually, there were a couple of courses like that. But the pragmatism course really stayed with me and has continued to be tremendously influential, as you will see in the book. Partly because pragmatism was so resourceful in bringing attention back or integrating abstract reflection with problems as they're lived through and encountered in the social and political arena. And the third major influence in graduate school was studying with Ruth Milliken. She has a teleosemantic account of meaning, which I haven't really followed up on in any technical way, but it really convinced me to emphasize the continuity between articulate human claims of the kind that you see in moral debate and other organic patterns of significance, to see human life as emergent and without being reductive, that is, without saying, well, it's really clear that morality is all about biological imperatives or something. I think she really inspired me to think in a naturalistic way that was still full of creativity and recognition of complexity.
Well, that's great. So why don't we turn to the book then? And as I said just a moment ago, this is a really original book, and it proposes a whole new orientation for moral theory. So maybe that gives us an especially good reason to start with a couple of the methodological or maybe even meta-philosophical issues that get addressed in the book. I want to quote from the very last page of the book, which I think where you have a sentence that's very, very interesting and might be a good sort of place to begin or to just prompt you to talk about some of the broader methodological stuff. You say on the last page of the book that the whole book has, I'm quoting here, has primarily been an argument against the very notion of garden variety conduct with which most moral philosophy seems to begin. And one of the themes that runs through the book in various methodological discussions is that when we start doing moral philosophy in a traditional way, we've already signed on to a certain kind of program with a certain set of concepts. And I take it that the book is aimed at not displacing those concepts entirely, but reorganizing the ways that we think about agency and intention and activity and the rest. So can you tell us a little bit about that broader sort of picture of moral philosophy as you see it and as you'd like to see it change?
Mm. In some ways, you might even say that this is a suggestion about how philosophers think about action, right? Not just moral philosophers. I'm interested in agency or activity in a very broad way, and that interest continues. And I've been, from the time I was doing my dissertation, especially interested in moral change or how patterns of activity shift over time and how we participate in those changes. And the reason that I'm problematizing conduct in that provocative quote at the end of the book is that I worry that moral philosophy's been preoccupied with an idea that morality is about the boiled down to something like codes of conduct. So we've got behavior on the ground, we're running around doing things, and then moral reflection prompts us to make judgments about what's going on the ground as people interact with each other in their world of conduct. And then I ask a question, or I began to ask a question many years ago, when I actually say something to another person, engage their attention with criticism, or when I listen to someone else's criticism for that matter, should I think of that as more conduct on the ground to be evaluated by the same standards that the rest of conduct is evaluated, or is it somehow does it exist on a plane of judgment that's different from conduct? And there are a number of philosophers who've wrestled with this question, but they've left it as a sort of a dialectic. So should we think of the effects of blame in terms of, say, their utilitarian outcomes, or should we think of whether blame is justified? The more I reflected on thinking of blame in particular as either conduct itself to be judged by a utilitarian or even a deontological standard or a virtue ethic standard, right, either as conduct or as justified or not as representation, right, the more I reflected on that, the more I realized that something had gotten lost, which was something about the how of our critical interventions. And certainly in my interactions with others, I was most drawn to respect those who had some wisdom in how they engaged others' attention when they engaged in criticism. And that's a different question from whether they're justified or whether the effects come out well in some kind of ultimate cashing out of consequences. And so that idea of gesture or of intervention as something that's happening in real time and that has a how to it, and it's fundamentally social, helps to intervene between the idea of a representation that's timeless and either justified or not, or conduct, which is very much in time but strictly belonging to an individual in the way it's usually conceived.
Right, and one of the diagnoses that that you propose of the sort of some traditional tracks in moral theory is you claim that it's morally solipsistic. Can you tell us a little bit about the solipsism that you see in some of traditional moral theory?
Yeah, I found it very difficult when trying to adopt some of the systematic moral frameworks that we celebrate in canonical moral theory. I found it very difficult to recognize the encounter of multiple moral agents in a way that exhibits moral agency. So let me step back and show that this has a variation in both of the celebrated moral theories that are most familiar, modern moral theories. So in consequentialist moral theory, there's certainly a high emphasis placed on intervening in the world of human affairs. If you can intervene and make a positive difference in the outcome for people and the balance of well-being over suffering, then you should. So it would seem that critical interventions are recommended. But there's a sense in which, from a consequentialist point of view, it's hard to say what it is to engage with another's agency, because it seems like if you could just dictate everybody else's behavior and have perfect knowledge, that would be better, right? Mm-hmm. If you could sort of turn yourself into a puppeteer to make things come out right, that would be sort of a paragon instance of consequentialist agency. What would it be for a consequentialist to take an interlocutor as a fellow agent seriously? Now, I don't think that actual consequentialists failed to do this. Mill, for example, Sidgwick, especially Mill, was really interested in dialogue.
Right.
But I don't think that consequentialist theory, especially when it gets spelled out in a systematic way, lends itself to that. And in fact, Sidgwick himself ended up sort of admitting that there are these communicative gaps that come up when you distrust the effects of your communication with an audience. Places where you shouldn't praise things that are in fact praiseworthy by his own lights, because the praise would be misunderstood, etc. So I was really interested in how consequentialists what it means to take another's agency seriously and how consequentialism seems to struggle with that. Now, certainly most deontological theorists will be shocked to say to hear some questioning of whether they are able to take the encounter of multiple moral agents seriously, because all of the talk of respect and dignity and autonomy and regard for another's moral agency is there in Kant and in other deontological thinkers. But there's a sense in which that very focus on autonomy and respect kind of unhooks us from engagement in a certain way, where deontological theory tends to suggest that what you ought to do as a critic is much more about expressing your rightly justified state of mind, and has no follow-through in the sense of being responsible for making sure something comes across, being responsible for uptake, as it were. What consequentialists would say are effects, but I want to stop short of saying we're responsible for the ultimate effects of our criticism, or that that's the real moral criterion. But we are always, in critical practice, certainly it behooves us to pay attention to questions of uptake and interpretation. And I don't see in deontological theory what it means to take the effect of one's communication into account. Because in some sense, the kinds of agents Kant imagines don't really affect each other.
Right.
So that's the way in which I see Kantian agents as kind of insulated from moral contact with one another. They're each in their sort of own bubbles, noumenal bubbles of will and principle. And I see consequentialist agents as not just contacting each other, but sort of easily bulldozing or puppeteering each other by the lights of, you know, what their theory would recommend, right?
Right.
Without saying that that's what the actual agents are doing.
Well, great. So before, you've already spelled out some of the beginnings of the prescription given the diagnosis. But before we, I ask you directly about this third set of concepts. I do want to ask one further methodological question, which is about something you mentioned in a moment ago about your own philosophical path, which is about pragmatism. So there are multiple parts, moments in the book where the pragmatism of John Dewey or G.H. Meade is brought up. Earlier in the book, the pragmatist that gets discussed is one that might be most surprising to people.
Yes.
Who know about these characters. So it's there's a Peircean strand to your moral theorizing. Now, let me just say for listeners who might not know this, Peirce was a very peculiar personality in all kinds of respects, and a very ambitious systematic thinker who had a very uneasy connection to ethics, both as an individual and as a theorist. And so he was constantly writing tables of contents for a mammoth philosophical work that was going to spell out his entire system. And in a lot of drafts of that table of contents, there's no or very little discussion of anything normative. But that's not to say that there isn't some real resources in Peirce's views. And so could you tell us a little bit about your interest in pragmatism, how you see pragmatism in general connecting up with this project, and also the sort of Peircean appeal to the Peircean, you know, the three categories, the firstness, secondness, and thirdness stuff, because I found that really intriguing.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say that Peirce wasn't concerned with normativity, but he really was nothing like the publicly engaged intellectual, and certainly not the progressive that Dewey and James and Meade and Adams, all of these, all of their classical pragmatist all of these other classical pragmatists are known for being very publicly engaged, and Peirce was not, no doubt. Cheryl Mizak makes a nice, acknowledgement of that fact. But her own work on Peirce, I think I recommend as one that draws out some of the implications of his work that he himself may not see. I'm not a Peirce scholar, and so I'm not at pains to argue that what I draw from Peirce is the best or true Peirce, but what I found in Peirce was a tool to break down the oppositional pattern of thought that I found so pervasive in philosophy between, say, in moral philosophy, the good and the right, right? And the way that those two poles just seem to be in a tug of war with each other, and views seem to end up shimmying in one direction or the other because of the pull of the neatness of categories such as the good and the right. And what Peirce did in his work on categories was to instill a habit of thought in me of looking for the third, and here's how I find it. And he doesn't quite articulate it this way, but that if you think about what consequentialists care about when they care about the good, it turns out to be something in the end like the quality of experience. Now, quality is the first of Peirce's three categories. And if you think about the right, you end up focusing on something like the truth, the justifiability, or the ultimate sort of big picture representational quality of judgments. And representation is one of Peirce's iconic concepts for thirdness. Okay, what Peirce does with the idea of secondness, which is so crucial in the book, is to say we need to recognize that there are qualities of and norms pertaining to and important reflection to be had about encounters as such.
Right.
So encounters aren't states like emotional states. They're not within an individual. They're not qualia like in any way.
right.
But they're also just not judgments. An encounter is not something to express in a sentence. As soon as you put it in a sentence, you've done something different from drawing attention to the encounter. And my suggestion throughout the book is that a moral encounter can have, I use the word aptness, it can be aptly carried out or can go well in a way that doesn't reduce down to good consequences afterwards or to its having exhibited a right judgment or right principle. And so throughout the book, when I think about moral change and criticism, I ask, when we encounter one another, what counts as orienting to that encounter well? So that's one way of looking at the Peircean bit. And then throughout the book, every time there's a dichotomy, I find myself really grateful to Peirce for giving me the discipline of thought to not just to say we need a compromise. You know, we need not just a blending of these two extremes, like between rationalism and empiricism, or between expressive and regulative accounts of moral response, but a qualitatively different direction in which to recognize something else going on.
Right. Excellent. And that is if there is a standard trope in pragmatist thinking, they are a pretty motley group philosophically. I mean, it really is that attention to the tendency for sort of conceptual dualisms to be false dualisms, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very, very interesting aspect of the book. But let's take up now the sort of what we might say is sort of the central plank of the positive proposal. Now, I take it that the main aim of communicating moral concern of the book is to bring into our moral theorizing, the idea that as moral creatures, we have to be concerned with each other's moral agency in a way that's not just, as you were saying before, not just an interest in regulating what they bring about in the world, and nor is it an interest simply in what actions express and how we express ourselves in reaction to what those actions are expressed, what intentions are being expressed there. But the idea of being responsive or of critical responsiveness, as you call it, is the activity of showing concern with how others exercise, or we might say enact, their agency, their status, as it were, as agent. And this is an intriguing thought that ever since I finished the book and actually went back and reread certain sections a couple of times, it's a really intriguing thought. Can you spell it out a little bit?
Sure.
And correct me if I haven't gotten it just
well,
right.
And here's a place where even I am constantly learning how my language has been shaped by these dualisms. So I'll take the expression showing concern that was part of your paraphrase and say that the showing is borrowed from the expressivist body of concepts. Right? So good critical practice, on my view, is something more than showing concern. It's actually getting concern across. It's actually engaging somebody's attention with a concern. So concern is not a sort of an emotional state that I exude or kind of broadcast, but is a pattern of noticing a problem. So problem is also a word that the pragmatists have, especially Dewey, have reflected upon very helpfully.
Sure.
Right. So when I engage somebody's attention with a concern, I draw their attention to the same problem that I'm paying attention to. And this is it's very important to me to find language to talk about a critical encounter or initiative that doesn't depend upon my having in advance a verdict, even a tentative verdict. This is what I'm really doing is trying to persuade you that what you did was wrong. Right? Or that what I'm really trying to do is to get you to behave differently. I guess I find myself quite often in an agnostic position in moral disputes, or a position of not being convinced that we found the right terms to talk about a problem. And I wanted a way to think about what we do when we say, wait a minute, something's going on here, where the something going on here isn't just a tactful way of saying somebody's done the wrong thing and I'm about to explain why. So communicating concern is sort of getting another person into relationship to the things that are provocative, the things that merit concern, but I'm open about how to describe that concern, and I'm enlisting somebody else's attention in sort of coming to terms with it, right? There's a nice expression, coming to terms with it,
right.
That is making the concern meaningful from their point of view. What are they going to go on and do with it? It can't be the same as what I would go on and do with it if we're actually different agents. And that's a kind of point that theorists of democracy like Dewey were at pains to emphasize. We can't just try to persuade one another in a democracy. We're actually looking for that collaborative mutual engagement on something that we have diverse perspectives on.
Right. So, and I take it that this is very centrally connected to this other or resulting sort of track in the book, where if the idea is to spell out this taking up of moral concern, or as you say, communicating moral concern, then the moral item that we're supposed to theorize then isn't the directive, isn't going to be a regulative principle, isn't going to be something like a reason. it's something else that you call a gesture. Can you tell us about that part of the account?
Well, I'll make first an ecumenical kind of gesture here, and say that in some ways, whatever it is that we're calling reasons, reasons towards moral judgments, etc., are part of what we can be communicating when we communicate moral concern. So it's not the case that you leave all your judgments and tentative judgments at home when you engage in critical interaction, if you're going to do it right. But I want to bring them into a wider category that includes everything that I would call a concern, where a concern is something, well, we talked a little bit about it already, a concern is a pattern of attention to a problem. I want to share that attention and work on it together, or sort of hand to you, ask you to take up a problem in a certain way. How we do it is by means of gesture. How we communicate concern is by means of gesture. And by saying that, I don't mean to say we never do it by means of outright articulate claims, judgments, standing up and saying, I think you're wrong.
Right.
That falls within the domain of gesture. Gesture includes all kinds of vocalizations, but it also includes not just the articulate ones, but the kinds of intonations and the kinds of fumbling for words that are so often a part of real hard moral conversations. And we tend to think, well, they're just trying to figure out what to say. On some level they are, but it's actually part of the process when we show our grappling with inarticulacy, and that all unfolds in time and in social space. We're showing that we're paying attention to the other's feedback continually as we're having this dialogue. We're wrestling for the right words. We're adjusting our claim in response to some protest or simply some something we recognize in another person's response to our ideas. So a gesture is a wider concept than something like advancing a claim, which then in a sort of a Robert Brandom-esque way, you know, we're going to enter into this giving and taking, giving and asking for reasons. There's a lot more going on in the interplay of gestures than that.
Right, and it's not, just to pick up on the contrast with Brandom, it's not a scorekeeping kind of enterprise either, I take it, right? It's a, one of the interesting things about the book is exactly, I mean, maybe all projects of this kind where you're trying to chart new territory, it's a kind of, I guess the word communicating, not in the sense of delivering just a message, but making common something that hadn't been recognized as such. Is that
right? Right. I really like, I chose the word communication because it actually has these roots in rather physical processes. I mean, obviously, I don't think moral criticism is like disease, but we have this idea of the movement of substances or of patterns as counting as communication, and that's the kind of the way in which communication works differently from something like expression, as a metaphor for something that enables the social movement or the social transfer of an idea or a consideration or a worry from one person to another.
Right. So let me then just ask, one of the features of the book is you're because the book is not a sort of slash and burn everything that came before and start anew, but an attempt, as we say, we're saying earlier, to reorient things. One of the moves that keeps recurring in the book is positioning the new relative to something more familiar as a way of refiguring the familiar so that it's more like it's the bridge between the old and what you're proposing. So one of the figures that is regularly coming up for discussion and comparison and in a way a reinterpretation is Peter Strawson. Mm-hmm. So it might help our listeners in helping to sort of think through this concept of critical responsiveness and the idea of communicating a concern, to pick up on some of the ways in which you contrast this view with a familiar set of tropes in moral theory, which mm-hmm. you see a lot of promise in, but still see the need to refigure, which is the Strawsonian account of the reactive attitudes, and then as it gets developed by some of people who are deeply influenced by him, the idea of a moral address and the second personal standpoint and these sorts of things. Can you tell us a little bit about how your view picks up from and then reorganizes that stuff and turns it into a new conceptual stuff?
Yeah. So Strawson, in some ways, is already doing a kind of version of what you're talking about. He's responding to determinism debates with a somewhat pragmatic, Kantian-inflected pragmatic gesture of saying, wait a minute, let's step away from these metaphysical debates about free will and instead really focus on the kind of practices people are engaged in and the difference it makes to us, what it's like to be engaged in relationships where things like moral blame and praise are at stake. And so in drawing attention to reactive attitudes, to all the ways in which it registers with us viscerally and socially when responsibility judgments are at stake, in doing that, he's trying to reorient a certain kind of philosophical debate in new but yet in some ways familiar terms, right? So I follow Strawson in that, and I think that the turn towards reactive attitudes is a step in a certain kind of right direction. What happens then, however, is that Strawson's discussion of reactive attitudes does a few things that I think end up further entrenching certain philosophical dichotomies. And in particular, first of all, attitudes are individual, and so we're thinking about what it means to experience resentment, and when I experience resentment, and to some degree, when I feel justified in experiencing resentment and expressing resentment, or when guilt is called for. Strawson, in thinking about these attitudes, ends up discussing them separately when, as we look at moral interactions from a social point of view, I see things like anger or resentment and guilt as actually forming part of a single social process, right? There's a dance of anger and guilt that happens and plays out in a social stage. And when you have only one half of that dance, there's a sense in which it's not really doing its thing very well. And of course, that's not to say it doesn't ever happen or that we shouldn't feel anger when there's nobody with whom to address it, or that we shouldn't ever feel guilty in the absence of someone remonstrating us. But anger and guilt are part of a social process, and something about the discussion of reactive attitudes tempts us to put them back in the psychological individual bubble. But more importantly, what I worry about in how influential Strawson's article is it was a great first step, but it ended up being really taken up with cheers in a literature that I wished had really developed it further, and I hope will develop it further. Specifically, the main pivotal argument in Strawson's Freedom and Resentment is basically a dichotomous argument. Right? Are we going to say that reactive attitudes are justified because of their success in regulating others' behaviors? Are we going to say that? Or are we going to say that this is simply something that's integral to our demonstrating and exhibiting and participating in moral life? Right? So by setting up that dichotomy, Strawson is very convincing that the regulative attitude is missing something. We're invested in these attitudes. I would say we're invested in the interactions in ways that go beyond their sort of success in procuring outcomes at the level of behavior. But if there's a third alternative, to either. I am expressing my commitment, and it's fundamentally about my moral convictions, right? That I have resentment, or that I blame, or that I have guilt. It's fundamentally about my participation in moral life that I exhibit these attitudes. If there's an alternative between, or in addition to either that, or it's all about getting you to behave in the way that I've already decided is morally optimal. If there's a third alternative, that needs to be heard. And reading Strawson's piece really sent me into, you know, hours of pacing back and forth, thinking about how to articulate what that third, maybe there are more than three, but at least a third alternative might look like.
Right, and it struck me as I was reading your treatments of Strawson that as central to the Strawson argument as that sort of participant stance or participant attitude is, there's not a lot, or there's almost nothing in the essay that spells out what the participating is participating in. It's just sort of a very, very thin, you know, conception of what the participants are doing together. Mm-hmm. And I take it that might be one way of characterizing sort of your own sort of expansion, maybe, or building upon, or a reworking of the Strawsonian thought that the participant attitude is a attitude of participating in something with others rather than just trading expressions of you know, indignation. Now the book also makes a nifty philosophical move, at least as I regard it, in that there's the book has sort of two parts, we might say, with an interlude that separates them. And the interlude is very intriguing to me. What happens in the interlude roughly in the middle of the book is you say, okay, I've been sort of talking about this idea of moral concern and critical responsiveness and moral criticism in a modular, as you call it, or as you were just saying, an ecumenical way, where I just want to, you say, I'm just calling attention to this dimension of the phenomena that seems under-theorized, and I've been trying to talk about it in a way that packages it in a way that can be sort of brought into whatever moral theory the reader might have started reading the book with. Mm-hmm. And then you say, but now I want to make a more bold move and try to, as you say, sort of promote a transformative understanding of these new phenomena. The second part of the book, then, is an attempt to show that the conceptual work that you've done, although it can be understood in the first pass as a sort of a modular thing, something new to be understood from within the existing terrain of moral theory, now the thought is, well, once we start seeing this phenomena as something that needs to be theorized, we will also have to start seeing it as something that needs to take a more central role in our theorizing. Is that right?
Right, right. So I take it that I haven't tried this out on lots of diehard committed moral theorists, those who have already chosen a camp, and most of them in practice are not quite so dogmatic as that makes it sound. But I take it that if we could conjure up somebody who's completely committed to the basics of, say, a Kantian account, it wouldn't be that hard to convince them or to draw out some agreement that even a Kantian agent doesn't actually think that it doesn't matter what others do. I mean, few Kantians today take that the sort of noumenal metaphysics of Kantian personhood seriously, as far as I can tell. That most of them would think that part of being somebody who cares about integrity and principles is being someone who cares about their how they are respected in the social milieu that they run in, and so they would say, "Well, I have to comport myself in accord with the categorical imperative, and I also, in some ways, am going to be a good ambassador for the categorical imperative. I'm going to, you know, bring it to others' attention. I'm going to engage in some kind of outreach or evangelism or correction of others when they seem to be corrupt in their behavior, that kind of thing, right? And that would be thinking that you can just leave moral theory as it is and then add do something in your social encounters with others that's true to that moral theory. And, of course, you can add that for a utilitarian view very easily. I know what it means to promote good outcomes, and I'm going to draw others' attention to that, too. I'm not just going to sort of bypass their attention and get them to do things with good outcomes. I'm going to bring them on board as part of my recognition of their being moral agents. Okay, so that way of thinking about the role of criticism suggests that moral theory gives you the substance of norms for conduct. And then in implementing those norms, part of it is in your own behavior and part of it is in your sort of social talking up of and persuasive ability to bring the cause to the attention of others. Right? So the modular account thinks about criticism as that kind of add-on outreach element of moral agency. But what I find the more I look at the process by which criticism can unfold is that you could take those the very ideals of conduct as they get talked about by moral theorists, but also by ordinary people more or less theoretically inclined, and think about all those ideals of conduct as themselves the sort of accretion over time, the products of critical processes and encounters, that those ideals didn't just sort of emerge from disembodied reason, or they're not inevitable with historical progress, that moral ideals are made. And then the question, well, what is it to be a moral agent? Could you really be a moral agent who doesn't participate in the reshaping, in the ongoing fashioning of what morality means? It strikes me that if anybody's ever participated in making morality what it is, not just carrying it out, right, that has to be integral to a really rich discussion of what moral agency is. And then we can think about all of our moral ideals of conduct as being a sort of an ongoing, tentative body of ideas that owe themselves to that critical process and that must be constantly revisited in light of critical questions and new social encounters.
Right, and so that's very helpful, and it does raise occasion to ask about one of the other sort of main, maybe the word foil is too strong. So Strawson keeps coming up as somebody that is worked with and worked against in some ways and updated in others. But also virtue ethics is one of the other sort of companions in this theoretical project. And so what you were just saying then about the making of the sort of making of morality or participating in fashioning morality sounds like at least certain versions of the virtue ethics approach. And yet, again, just like with the Strawsonian materials, you're interested in saying, well, this is a step in the right direction or something that is grasping at what the moral concern view is trying to promote. So how do you understand how do you understand the relation of your view to some contemporary, at least, virtue ethical accounts?
As your last comment makes clear, virtue ethics is a much more diverse body of thought than, say, Strawson's Freedom and Resentment, right? A single article. And so anybody who participates in virtue ethics simultaneously defines it or redefines it or offers some nugget as a suggestion of what makes virtue ethics what it is. What I find most helpful in virtue ethics is those strands of virtue ethics that focus on the attentive, embodied how of interaction, in saying the interesting questions are not, is it justified to X or not, but when you're in a certain kind of situation, what distinguishes a really excellent response from one that's kind of clumsy or excessively dogmatic, or in some other way insensitive to the demands of the situation. Virtue ethics is wonderful in foregrounding how, rather than whether or not, as a central question, and that's been true throughout virtue ethics. There are certainly lots of virtue ethicists who also think that at the same time as foregrounding how, they have to foreground the idea of individual character and the idea of a certain set of traits that an individual has that either exemplify virtues, or they exemplify certain virtues and certain vices, or maybe either just virtue as a sum or lack of virtue. And I don't see any reason when we're talking about activity to assume that excellence in that activity has to come in the form of an individual trait that underlies always doing it well. Of course, there are habits in our moral interactions, and virtue ethicists have been really attentive to the process of habit development. But habits can develop in interactions. They can develop in social groups. They can develop in cultures. Right? There are all sorts of ways that patterns take shape and then dissipate, and they don't all take place at the level of the shaping of an individual character or personality. So my interest in virtue ethics is compatible with many of the moves, for example, in Christine Swanton's pluralistic virtue ethics, in particular because her pluralism really makes room for having a diverse range of concerns. And I'd like to add, or really encourage people attracted to that line of thought, to recognize how much criticism challenges them to displace or question the idealization of tradition and learning from exemplars. Because criticism often involves confronting the old with a new kind of challenge. And virtue ethics has been especially quiet on the front of moral change, and you know, many threads of virtue ethics are highly conservative in their tone, but they don't have to be, and they wouldn't have to be if they could just think about critical practice as itself something that you can learn to do more or less well, and that people in interactions can find themselves being able to learn from.
Right, and I take it that one of the other places where your account is going to diverge, at least from some mainstream virtue ethics views, including contemporary virtue ethics views, is just on this point with the exemplars, where you know a lot of mainstream virtue ethics views do at some point appeal to that old Aristotelian thought about phronesis. There is a perceptual kind of faculty that is individual, that some people have and other people don't, and maybe it can be developed in some ways and not others. And that somehow virtue or the bringing together of the virtues is a matter of a kind of individual psychological ability to see things in a certain way. And I take it that your account wants to, if it's going to displace anything, that's one of the things that has to be gotten rid of in virtue ethics. Is that right?
Yeah, if we think about something like John McDowell's Virtue and Reason, its account of phronesis encourages us to think that the phronimos has a kind of an inarticulate expertise, and in a certain kind of encounter, there's nothing more he, always figured as he, you know, can say to convince somebody who doesn't inhabit wisdom in the way that the phronimos does. And I think that here McDowell has fallen into the trap of contrasting having a thing to say, as in having a persuasive reasoned account, right? He's contrasted that against silence and sort of say, well, there's nothing more to say. And in fact, there are plenty of communicative things that a phronimos does in encounters with people who are not wise. And some of those things include being quite circumspect about the extent of their own wisdom. right? Not knowing in advance that one is has the grounds to silence, using McDowell's idea, right? That one's confidence about what to silence is always well justified. So I think the phronemos in Confucius is actually much more interesting. Phronemos is, of course, not a Confucian concept, but the Confucian sage and Confucius himself often shows a kind of attentiveness when he's in dialogue with someone who's different or comes from a different place or a different tradition, or when he's in the midst of a ceremony with unfamiliar people. There's a kind of holding back to be receptive. And maybe this is somewhat similar to Socrates, at least some ironic gestures of being the person who needs to learn. And the thing about really good irony is it's not sarcasm. It's not I'm pretending I need to learn. It's a sort of a holding in suspense whether I have something to learn here in this encounter.
That's right. Let me ask one sort of final question about the book, and then I'll thank you for your time and ask one broader question. So the concluding remarks, which the book ends with, concluding reflections, appropriately called, spells out in some, I think, very interesting ways, or gives a suggestion, maybe is a gesture towards some of what you see as the social and political implications of these sort of reorienting interventions that you've been enacting in this book. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the ways in which you think that some of the habits that you're trying to reorient are responsible for some things that you think are problematic in our current social and political environment, and some of the ways in which you think that the kind of account you're developing might help to ameliorate some of those difficulties?
We could spend another hour here.
I know. Sorry.
maybe I'll just say two little things here.
That would be great. Yeah, yeah.
One is that the preoccupation with justified judgments and their expression lines up with various kinds of what I think of as abject moral failures in practice, failures of solving real problems. So one example of how a focus on justification allows us to bypass the questions of how and communication is when we think about practices of punishment. And of course, the United States right now is egregious in its practices of imprisonment. We have a very large population behind bars, and our preoccupation with the grounds and whether or not these people really did something that deserves to be punished has eclipsed our thinking about what it means for us to respond effectively and to come to terms with what the problems are that are bound up with crime. And so we individualize the moral problem into the personality of a prisoner and say, well, we're expressing basically our disapproval. And there's no doubt that every hour of the day, people who are subjected to imprisonment are well aware of the disapproval of society, right? It's sort of written on their walls as well as on their bodies and their clothing. Mm-hmm. And yet, what it would mean for them to take up that challenge, right, to move forward responsibly is actually blocked by the very process of imprisonment, right? We have not figured out how to communicate concern about, say, crimes in such a way that the people who to whom we address that concern are positioned then to do something to intervene based on their own particular perspectives and insights. We have a profound distrust in that communicative process. That's not to say it's easy, right? But I think that a focus on communication and what it means to be in dialogue with wrongdoers, rather than to express and make clear and demonstrate the unacceptability of what they've done, I think that is a crucial piece of finding our way out of that problem.
Right.
And then the other thing that, and this actually might turn towards my future work, if that's a good place to go, is in our thinking about our moral relationships and interactions with the world beyond human society. Mm-hmm. So I'm particularly thinking about our ecological predicament, clearly climate change, what I think of as global volatility. Warming sounds so nice, but our effect on the worldwide climate systems, but also our tremendous impact on other species. So if we think that morality is fundamentally the possession of justified claim-making, deliberate language-using, accountable agents, right, we tend to see those questions as kind of peripheral, as in the penumbra of real morality, which is about human-human relations. And the more I think about moral responsiveness as responsiveness to embodied gestural communication and to sort of currents or patterns of signals and communications and interpretable signs of what's going on in the world, the more I think about morality as a responsiveness in this broader way, the more I want to undermine that intuition that morality is a fundamentally human practice, and to think about the uptake of concern as something that, and the communication of concern as something that's not uniquely human. And even if there are aspects of it that forms and complexities to it that are especially distinctive of human beings, that we are part of a physically and meaningfully connected interrelationship with lots of beings who are not human, and our moral responsiveness to them is something that we've barely begun to have a clue about. So what that might look like, how we can turn ourselves and one another in that direction is the subject of what I've been thinking about most recently.
Yeah, and that sounds very exciting, and perhaps when that work comes to fruition, I'll try to get you back on the podcast. But it does seem that the way in which your view sort of tries to break the dichotomy between the sort of regulative morality, where you're just trying to pull the right levers, and the expressive does seem to open up all kinds of spaces for non-human participants in moral life for that reason. Mm-hmm. Well, great. Elise, you've been really generous with your time, and it's been great to talk to you about your book, Communicating Moral Concern and Ethics of Critical Responsiveness. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Well, take care now.
You too.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Elise Springer of Wesleyan University. We're talking about her new book, Communicating Moral Concern and Ethics of Critical Responsiveness, recently published by MIT Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.